KA19.
4, 3.
Where we kick ass.
2, 1.
Hey Sequoia, I'm Trent Schuyler with Evelyn Saranjanath, and we're your hosts this morning for our third KA19 podcast. Evelyn, how are you this morning, and what's the lineup for today?
Thanks, Trent. I'm absolutely splendiferous today. I love animals, so I'm really looking forward to this episode of our KA19 podcast. If you remember, we've had Ventura County Sheriff's Department Dispatch Supervisor Debbie Castro and Adrian and Chris with the Ventura County EMS Agency as our guests. Today, we are switching it up a little with a pretty exciting topic and guest. In the studio, we have equine vet and zoology professor Dr. Betsy Connolly. Dr. Connolly, thanks for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, so before we start off with all the questions about your job, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I grew up on the East Coast, New York and New Jersey. Some people can still hear it in my accent. And after I graduated from high school, I went to University of Denver for my undergrad, so that's Colorado. And while I was at University of Denver, I was a pre-med major, so I was planning on being a physician. But there was a requirement at University of Denver that if you were a pre-med major, you had to find another possible career because they were worried that if you got turned down, you might be struggling. So they had this was before computers, they had these filing cabinets before the internet kind of computers. They had this big giant room full of filing cabinets with all the other allied health fields. So you had to go in and look through the files. So I looked through the files, and I was like, didn't like any of the choices, and I got all the way to the last filing cabinet, pulled out the file for veterinary medicine, and I thought, why did I never think about this? And I opened the file, read how you went about becoming a veterinarian, and 2 weeks later, I was a pre-vet major. What I didn't know at the time was that it was harder to get into veterinary school than it was to get into medical school. So that's how I ended up at University of Denver, and then I worked for a couple of years, and I was accepted to Colorado State University, which is the Colorado Veterinary School, and I went there for 4 years, and when I graduated, I worked briefly for the university, and then I came out here to California to do private practice, so that's my journey story.
Wow, that's really cool. As I said at the beginning, I love animals, so let's dig in with the questions. Dr. Connolly, can you tell us what inspired you to become an equine vet and a zoology professor? Have you always done both, or which job did you start first? Do you have a favorite?
So for 20 years, I was a private practice equine veterinarian. So that means that every day I did appointments looking at and taking care of horses. So the kind of veterinarian that I was is called ambulatory. So ambulate means to walk or to travel, right? And so an ambulatory veterinarian is one who travels to the horse. So my office was in like a tech building, you know, it looked like a manufacturing place. It didn't have anywhere that horses could come. And I had a truck that had all of my equipment and my medications and a driver who also assisted in holding the horses while they were being treated. And we drove from appointment to appointment to appointment all day long. So that was the job that I started when I left the university and started into private practice here in California. And my practice was actually, the office was in Simi Valley, It was called Tri-Valley Equine Clinic. People used to say, what are the three valleys? And I would say Simi Valley, Conejo Valley, and whatever valley you are in. So we did like a big circle. So the San Fernando Valley and Malibu and Somis, places like that.
What's the difference between like a private practice equine vet and like a regular equine vet?
There isn't any difference. So we call it private practice, but what it means is it's a business, right? Where you have employees and you have to make enough money to pay them. And if you don't, then you go bankrupt, right? It's like a business, like a store. The other way that some veterinarians work is they work for a university. And in fact, I did that for the first 6 months after I got done with school. I worked for Colorado State University doing research on equine reproduction. So I worked there for them. That is not private practice, right? That is working at a university. Yeah.
Okay, so how did you like juggle both of the professions?
So, you know, I didn't do both at the same time. So what happened was when I have two kids, you were right about that, by the way. I have two kids, and when they got to middle school, it got very complicated for me. So when my kids were little, when they were at daycare in the middle of the day, or they had a nanny. And then when the work day for daycare ended, I would pick them up in my truck, which had a back seat. And I would take them on my calls because my work day was much longer than their preschool day. And so that worked out really well when they were little. Because if they had to stay up late, they could just sleep in the morning, and it was pretty good. And when we got to calls, they would sit on top of the roof of the truck because I didn't want them to be underfoot where they might get trampled by a horse. And so they would sit up on top of the roof of the truck, offer advice, and watch what was going on. But when they got to middle school, close your ears here, Miss Stevenson. Their teachers were not as tolerant of my crazy schedule and its effect on their homework and school attendance. So it was pretty clear to me that I needed to make a shift. So I retired from private practice and I started teaching horse science, equine science classes at Pierce College. And so I moved. That's one of the great things about a veterinary degree is you can do a lot of stuff with a veterinary degree. So I started out in doing university research work. Then I did private practice. Then I taught at the college level, all using the same degree, veterinary medicine, that I had in the beginning.
Since your kids went on calls with you, do they have a love of horses?
You know, yes and no. Neither of my children were interested in pursuing veterinary medicine, and my husband is a small animal veterinarian, so they grew up around animals and around veterinary medicine, and my son today is a mechanical engineer who does 3D design, right? And my daughter is a financial auditor CPA. So neither of those have to do with medicine at all. But my daughter did ride horses when she was little, they are both very comfortable around horses. When I was thinking about funny things that had happened while I was in practice, and one of them was one day when my son James and my daughter Kate were sitting on the roof of the truck. They probably 3.5 and 5. And my assistant and I were treating a horse that had colic. Colic is a really common and very serious medical problem in horses, where the intestinal tract develops a problem, and it's the most common cause of death in horses. So anyway, we were treating a horse that had colic, which meant that it had terrible abdominal pain and wanted to roll around and just like you would if you had terrible abdominal pain. So anyway, we're struggling with this horse that's in pain, treating it. And my son, 3 and a half, remember, he shouts out from the top of the truck, "Mom, I think it's colic." And the owners of the horse turned around like, "Are you kidding? Little tiny child making, the diagnosis." But he was right, by the way. But the other thing is, we had a lot of time together driving around, and this was before there were like those video screens in the back of vehicles where kids could watch movies and things like that. There was nothing to do. So we told stories, and it was a great life. And they spent a lot of time in my office. They got to know everyone who worked for me and all of my clients. And, you know, another lesson that they learned was, it's not your turn. Because there were a lot of times when they were with me where they couldn't talk because I was talking to a client, or they couldn't have they were hungry, but they couldn't eat yet because we were taking care of a horse. And so I hope that I haven't asked them, I should ask them. I hope that they learned that it is okay for an adult to be in a leadership role, and that a mom doesn't always have to be making their comfort of their child their top priority every minute of the day.
Let's talk about your career as an equine vet. From our research, there are several different aspects of being an equine vet. We read that many times an equine vet can spend time outdoors on visits to ranches, racetracks, or even breeders. They even provide many different services besides wellness checks like fertility and surgery. Have you done any of that, and can you share with us exactly what your job entails?
Sure. So I actually did a fair amount of work to do with reproduction. So that means getting mares pregnant and taking care of foals. And we have a lot of breeding facilities, a lot of places in Ventura County where mares are bred and foals are raised. And so I did that work for for Colorado State before I came out here, so I already had a reputation and a skill set in reproductive medicine, and so I did a lot of work at reproduction farms. But I also did a lot of regular care, because remember, I was an ambulatory veterinarian, which means that everything that I did was outside. Even if I did surgery on a horse, which we did quite regularly, we anesthetized the horse in a field. And when it became unconscious, we rolled it over and did the surgery we needed to do right there out in the open. If that wasn't the right place to do the surgery, then we put the horse in a trailer and sent it to a specialty hospital where that work was done. So everything we did was outdoors.
I'd imagine becoming an equine vet takes years of schooling and specialized training, correct?
So, yes, it is correct. Yeah.
Okay, so if someone wanted to pursue this field, what schooling is required, and are there certain personal characteristics or traits that are considered helpful in order to be successful?
So here in California, we're kind of lucky because we have a state veterinary school. It's at University of Colorado of California, Davis, right up north of us. And we also have a private veterinary school called Western, which is down in the southern part of California. That school is really just small animal training. So if you want to be an equine veterinarian or a food animal, that's what we call the other kind that does cows and sheep and goats and stuff, a food animal veterinarian, then you have to go to Davis, or you could go out of state. But here's the reason why you want to go to Davis. Way cheaper, because as an in-state resident, the people who live in California help to pay for that university education. When you go out of state, you have to pay, and it is a very expensive thing, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So most California residents who want to become veterinarians go to Davis. And so in order to get into veterinary school, you need a bachelor's degree. And the bachelor's degree doesn't have to be in biology or pre-vet or another science, but it usually is, because by the time you meet all of the requirements, the calculus, the physics, the biology classes, the chemistry classes, you pretty much have a major. My major in undergrad was biology, and I have a double minor in math and chemistry. I don't even like math and chemistry, but by the time I finished taking the classes that I had to take in order to be accepted into veterinary school, I had all the credits for those two minors, so that's how that happened. So 4 years of undergraduate training with a focus on science is what you have to do in order to meet the requirements to go to veterinary school. And then, of course, you have that's 4 years undergrad. Then you have 4 years in veterinary school. And then when you graduate, you actually have to take boards. So you have to take a national veterinary exam, and if you don't pass it, you cannot practice. And then you have to take a state veterinary exam for whatever state you're working in, or you cannot have a license. So there are steps along the way. Now, I have to tell you that it is extremely rare for anyone who graduates from veterinary school not to pass the national and state boards. Very, very rare. And once you get into veterinary school, the odds of staying in are excellent. There are not that many dropouts. And once you complete it, your odds of being a licensed veterinarian are excellent as well.
That's a lot of schooling.
It is a lot of schooling, but a secret I'm going to tell you is that school is fantastic when compared to work. So no one should be in a rush to get to work. If you can go to school and stay in college, it's a way more lovely time of life than working every single day forever. So it is a lot of school, but remember, you're learning interesting things in veterinary school, and a lot of it is hands-on. So your lab is like surgery lab, where you're actually doing surgeries, and your large animal unit is going out to farms and taking care of livestock. So it's not sitting in a classroom having someone show you a bunch of slides. It's actual hands-on. And if a person doesn't like that, they're probably working toward the wrong career, right?
Yeah. What's the most challenging part about your job and your favorite aspect of practicing veterinary medicine?
So I'm going to say to you that equine medicine is dangerous. And a lot of people get hurt, a lot of veterinarians get hurt, and a fair number are killed. So horses are big. They weigh 1,200 pounds. They're super strong, and they're very, very fast. And then they have these big clubs at the ends of their legs called hooves, and they can do a lot of damage. And so safety is a very important part of equine practice. And that means, like safety in every kind of work, it means doing the right way every single time. No shortcuts, right? Because it's the shortcuts. It's when you're in a rush or when you're angry, right, or tired, that you make the kinds of mistakes that end up getting you hurt. So safety is the thing that equine veterinarians work around every day. And it's not just their personal safety. It's the safety of their assistant, right, who is oftentimes in as much harm's way as they are. And then of the clients and people who are working in the stables who we're responsible for as well when we're on a call. So putting the safety aspect aside, the next thing is horses aren't just super strong and super fast. They're also scaredy cats. You know, they are what we call a fight or flight animal. So the fight is the kicking and the biting and the shoving, right? But the flight part is the running away thing. Or it's very easy to make a horse afraid. And because I teach at Pierce College, I have a stethoscope, which is the thing that you listen to the heart with, right? Mm-hmm. I have a stethoscope that has two sets of earpieces, one for the student and one for me, and then one head that goes against the chest of the horse. So one of the things that I have learned as I have taught students how to listen to the heart is that when I approach a horse and I listen to the heart rate goes way up, even if the horse seems quiet. And then after a couple of minutes of me being calm and them being calm, the heart rate comes back down again. But then when the student comes and puts the stethoscope in their ears so that there's two of us standing next to the horse, heart rate goes up. And then if nothing bad happens, heart rate comes back down again. So they are nervous all the time. Even when they seem calm, they are watchful. And if you look at the ears of a horse, they point forward. They point at what they are worrying about. And so when they point forward, it's what's in front of them. Maybe it's us. When they rotate their ears back, it's they're worrying about what's behind them. And so horses will tell you with their ears what they're worrying about. But the thing that, so the techniques that we use as equine veterinarians are calming techniques. Things that we do, the way that we put our hands on the horse, the way that we scratch or pat them, the voice that we use is how we keep them from fleeing, right? Because they could run away any moment. The fact that they don't run away has to do with the skill of the handler and the veterinarian. So that's our second thing. Don't freak the horse out, right? Don't get hurt. Don't freak the horse out. And something comes to mind that I want to tell you about is that sometimes things don't go the way you're hoping they're going to go. And you do end up in an argument with a horse, drug around a paddock, kicked, maybe the horse rears up or bites, you know, and things get very crazy super quickly, right? So I learned over the years that if that happens and you leave that call, you should not go immediately to the next call because the horse will know at the next call that bad things happened at the call before. So what we used to do when things went really badly is we'd go to Jack in the Box or McDonald's and get a soda and just sit out in the parking lot and relax for 10 minutes. Before we would go to the next call after a tough call. And then the horses at the next call wouldn't be reading that. And I don't think they were smelling trouble on us. I think that we were a little more fearful, a little more impatient, a little more quick to be angry. And the horses could hear it, and they felt it in the things that we did. So they are incredibly sensitive animals, and it is really it's like a Zen exercise to work safely around horses. You have to calm yourself down all the time if you don't want trouble.
So have you ever gotten hurt or kicked by a horse?
I have gotten kicked by horses many times. I'm happy to say that I should knock on something when I say this. I'm happy to say that I have never required medical attention, nor has one of my assistants required medical attention for the injuries we sustained taking care of horses. I was significantly injured by a cow. That happened when I was in veterinary school, and we were standing in super deep mud. And so that means I couldn't move my feet, right? Yeah. And I was doing something called palpating, which is when you've seen it if you've watched All Creatures Great and Small or something like that. You put on a shoulder-length glove, and you cover it with lube, and you stick it into the rectum, the place where the poop comes out, and you feel the reproductive organs of the animal, whether it's a cow or a horse. So you're feeling the ovaries and the uterus. It's how we tell whether they're pregnant or whether they're ready to breed. Anyway, I was doing this. It was while I was still in school. And so imagine I'm up to my shoulder inside the cow. The cow is in a holder, a squeeze thing. And then I'm behind with below my knees stuck in the mud. And the cow kicked me. And cows are very good at kicking straight back. It's their superpower. And kicked me and hit me right on the kneecap. And my leg went whoop, whoop, and I tore my cruciate. Yeah. And so, which is the ligament that holds your knee together. So that's the only time when I have required medical attention because of an injury from a patient. But it was not a horse.
Wow. Medicine has really advanced over the years, especially with the use of technology. How do you stay up to date on advances in veterinary medicine?
So veterinarians are required by their state license to have professional development training. And so you have to do a certain number of hours every year in order to keep your license active. And there are conferences all over the country where you can get those credits. And now, in modern times, especially after COVID, you can do some of that training online as well. But at those conferences, you get to see the latest in equipment and the vendors who are hoping to sell you that equipment are there to show you how to use it. And so that's one way a veterinarian stay up to date. Also, by reading journals. We get journals in the mail, and we keep up to date by reading those journals. And then I'm going to say, lastly, you can't keep up to date on everything. And that's why there are specialists. And oftentimes we would send a horse to a specialist if they needed a procedure that was outside of our skill and experience level. And those specialists are also consultants. So I could pick up the phone and ask for advice from someone who only did one particular kind, like maybe they were an equine ophthalmologist, so all they did was eyes for horses. And of course they would know a lot more than a regular private practice veterinarian.
Yeah. So I know you talked about how you had to do like a Zen moment or whatever when you're with the horse. So like, what are some like more specific ways that like some strategies that you use to calm the horse?
Yeah, that's a good question actually, and I've thought a lot about this because when I teach horse science at Pierce College, I'm trying to explain to my students how to do that. And so it's not enough for me to just know how to do it. I also need to help my students realize how to do it. And I have to tell you that a lot of times my students are like, I don't understand why the horse won't let me do this procedure when they let you do this procedure. And so then I'm like, okay, so try this. You know, so some examples. I always keep my hand flat when I touch a horse. I never curl my fingers.
I've been told.
And touch just with the tips of my fingers. And the more surface area that you touch a horse with, the better the response that they have. And you know, it's kind of a two-way street. A lot of people who have anxiety find working around horses calms them down. And I think that when you flatten your hands and you place them on a horse, it's a two-way calming thing. They calm down and you calm down. And so I always encourage my students first, slow down, right? Because rushing is the number one thing that gets horses freaked out. And I think that if we had someone here to talk to us about mindfulness and strategies for anxiety, they would say the same thing, right? Step one, take a breath, calm down, slow down, right? And then use your hands and touch physically. Second thing is get in close. People, if they're afraid of a horse or if a horse is afraid of them, the first thing that happens is they get apart from one another. They separate themselves. And the further apart you are, the greater the fear. The closer together you are, the less the fear. So when I am trying to calm a horse down or teach someone else to calm a horse down, the first thing I want to do is to put my hands flat, and the second thing is to stay close. If I can, I will press my whole body against the horse, right? So I will touch their leg with my leg, their shoulder with my hip, their chest with my arm, so that I am in as much contact as possible. It also has a good safety feature because when you are in full contact with the horse, if it does rear or jump or shove, you're pushed out of the way. Whereas if you're at the very tip and the only thing that's touching them is the ends of your hand, it's very easy for them to build up velocity, speed, and knock you hard. So when people are afraid that a horse is going to kick them when they walk behind it, they tend to put their arm out and walk far away. Bad strategy. If you don't want to get hurt when you pass behind a horse, walk right behind the horse. Touch the horse and keep as close as possible. Sure, you could still get kicked, but I promise you, the kick isn't going to be anywhere near as painful as if you are 3 feet away. Think of it like a baseball. No, think of it like a baseball bat. That if you are going to get hit by that, it would be better to be very close to the hands of the holder of the bat, right? Not far away so that they can take a full power swing at you. Same strategy is what we use for horses. And so safety and calming are really very closely connected.
So what is like the most difficult procedure you've had to do? And, like, how did you handle it?
So I thought about this because I knew that you were going to ask me about things that have happened in the past, and so I'm going to share with you a story that was one of my kids' favorite practice stories when they were young. And this is a story about a little horse. Her name was April. And when I got the call to see April, the owner called my office. My office radioed me because we didn't have cell phones yet. And then they told me what was going on. And this is what they said. The owner of the horse called, and the horse is stuck in the spa. So we're like, okay. So we drive up there, and we get to the house, and it turns out that, yes, the horse is stuck in the spa. And here's what happened. Here's how April ended up in the spa. She was tied to a hitching post in the front yard of the house, and she pulled back and broke the rope. And because it was windy and a tumbleweed blew past her, like today. And so once she was loose, she wanted to go home to her stall. So she ran around the side of the house. But around the side of the house was one of those metal portable dog pens because they had puppies. And she ran into the metal pen, and it sort of exploded, right? Which completely freaked her out. So she went into a panic run, right? Now she's not just trotting around looking for her house. Now she's in lions are attacking me mode. So she runs around to the back of the house, and she can see her stall, and that's where she wants to go. But what she doesn't see is the pool and the spa that are between her and the stall. So she's galloping at this point, the fastest she can go, and she gets up on the tile around the deck of the pool. And she's galloping, and she falls into the spa. She falls into the spa, she ends up upside down. So her legs are sticking up, her head is on the tile, and her body is in the spot where you sit or where your feet go, right? And she's stuck. So she can't get up because she filled the whole size of the spa. So I go back there. I talk to the owner, and I said, okay, so we're going to need a crane or a tow truck to get your horse out of here, or we're going to need about 20 people. Yeah. She says to me, no problem. I already have a crane on the way. So I can hear the shifting of gears. Sure enough, one of those giant cranes is headed up the road that you would like drop a swimming pool or a piece of equipment into a backyard, right? It parks next door in the empty lot, swings the big boom over. So meanwhile, I put an IV into the jugular vein of the horse and gave it some anesthetic, because I'm sure you can imagine horses are not incredibly fond of being lifted by cranes, especially by their legs, which was the only part of the horse that was available to us, right? So what we did is we took... So right about then, the fire department shows up. I forgot that part. So the owner of the horse starts serving refreshments, and it was a very odd scene. Oh my gosh. The firefighters are there. So what we did is we took the, what are they called? The fire hoses, right? And we used them as ropes, and we tied one to each one of the legs of the horse. Then we tied those together in a knot and made a loop. And then the crane, I anesthetized the horse. The crane came down. We put the hook in the loop. We raised the horse up. The crane turned. We lowered it onto the ground, onto the grass, undid it all. The horse woke up. It stood up. It just had a little bump next to its eye. Other than that, it was fine. So that is a great example of the kooky and maybe very stressful, right? Certainly stressful for the owner and the horse, and kinds of things that happen in equine practice all the time.
Wow. Do you have, like, any other stories that you could share with us?
Sure. I have to look at my notes. Oh, I'll tell you a different one that is kind of just funny and not so... So I'll tell you two stories. One of them is a story about the a client who called saying that her horse had been attacked by a mountain lion.
Oh, no.
And this was out in Bell Canyon, so we went out there, and when we arrived, the owner was in the paddock. It was like a big area. Kind of open with open space behind it. And the owner was there with a pitchfork in her hands, fiercely ready if the mountain lion came back, right? The horse had these four terrible puncture wounds in its haunches, in its back hindquarters. And it could have been a mountain lion, but my experience with mountain lion injuries is that they don't look like that. If a mountain lion grabs a horse from behind, they usually are doing it with their claws, and we see these long rake marks that go down so that the skin is cut in sort of slithers. And this was more like what you would see if the world's largest mountain lion bit the horse. And so I was, so we looked around the place where the horse was, and a few days earlier, some landscapers had cut down some bushes, but they hadn't removed the very bottom of the trunk. Instead, they had cut them at an angle, and they were sticking up about 6 inches, super sharp. And what had happened, and I could see the blood on them, what had happened is that the horse had laid down to sleep during the night, and when it went to get up, horses do this weird rocking thing where they roll back and forth, and it had rolled onto the stumps, and the stumps had shoved into the muscle of the hindquarters of the horse. So the pitchfork was not necessary, which is, but I will always remember how fierce she was and how ready she was to fend off a mountain lion if it had been one, right? So I like that story because it's a fond memory. So I'll tell you another story. When I was in private practice, I was approached by the Ventura County Humane Society and the Los Angeles Humane Society to provide them with advice on animal cruelty cases. And I agreed to do that. So while I was still in private practice, I was also doing cruelty work for the Los Angeles SPCA and the Ventura County SPCA. So one of the cases that we had a lot of cases. I went to calls where we went with a SWAT team, and there were where we were behind barricades while horse owners were ordered to come out and surrender their weapons, kind of thing, and shots were fired. But this particular call happened in Simi Valley in the area that is now called Wood Ranch. But at the time, it was just a ranch, right? And there was a rancher who was not feeding his horses. And it was a tough time weather-wise, kind of like now with a drought, and so there wasn't enough naturally growing food for the horses. And they got skinnier and skinnier and skinnier until they were really starving. And people would see them and call into the SPCA. And so finally, the police, the sheriffs, and the animal control officers, and me and my assistant, it was time to go in and do something. So we all assembled on the side of the road, you know, Madera Road that connects Simi to Thousand Oaks, if you've ever driven over there. And we were all there. There must have been 40 people.
Wow.
But the horses were out of sight because there's a hill there, kind of near the Reagan Presidential Library. There's a hill there, and the horses had gone behind the hill. So the rule is that the sheriff's deputies had to see the starving horses in order to enter private property. There has to be reasonable expectation that a crime has been occurred. So we were, we're all standing around trying to decide what to do because...
Trying to get the horses.
Right. And so a client of mine drives by, pulls over to the side of the road, hops out, comes to me, and she says, "What's going on here?" Because she can see the horse trailer and the county rig and all the cops, and she can see my veterinary truck. And she says, "What's going on?" And so I explained. And she grabs a halter and a lead rope out of her truck, hops the barbed wire fence, and starts walking into the property. And the sheriff's deputies are like, lady, what are you doing? You're not allowed there. It's private property. She completely ignores them. She walks over the hill, throws the lead rope over one of these starving horses, puts on the halter, brings it back. All the other horses follow. She takes the halter off of the horse. She hops the barbed wire fence. She gets back in her truck, and she drives away. And the sheriff's deputy comes to me and says, "Who was that lady?" And I said, "I have no idea." So that's how we ended up being able to take the horses, right? We cut the barbed wire fence, we loaded all of the horses into the trailer, and they were taken away to the Ventura County Animal Shelter, and then eventually to a ranch where they were fed until they recovered. And then the owner of the property was taken to court and charged with animal cruelty and banned from owning horses for 10 years.
Wow. Every now and then we hear news stories about, like, puppy mills or abuse happening to animals. Like, what actions would you need to take if you saw signs that a horse you're treating is being abused?
Yeah, so that definitely happens. I'm going to say neglect is probably more common than abuse. Abuse isn't unheard of, though, but neglect is super common. Food for horses is quite expensive, and people get in trouble financially, and then they stop feeding their horses, and they don't see a way out of it. And so that is a really common thing. Not only do horses need food, they also need their feet trimmed. And so that's expensive, easily $100 a month just for trimming. And so when people get into financial trouble, or they're just really depressed and they're not taking care of themselves and their animals properly, neglect is very common. So it is common for neighbors to call when they see animal cruelty or neglect. And as a private practice veterinarian, we would refer them to the Ventura County Animal Reg or the LA County Animal Reg. And those officers, that's their job. They come out and they look to see what is going on. And then they call someone like me there's a new me now, but someone like me who comes out with them to decide whether these horses are neglected or abused, and if so, whether they want to take them away. And then ultimately, that goes to trial, right? And so the veterinarian, like me, ends up testifying in court as to what was seen and why the decision was made to take the animals away.
Have you actually gone into court to testify?
Oh, yes, many times. There's a lot of waiting involved in being a witness in a trial. So my advice to anyone who is ever accused of animal neglect or cruelty is never ask for a jury trial. Always just let the judge decide on your sentence, because judges see all kinds of terrible things every day, because crime and the punishment for it is their job. The public who end up on juries, they hate people who don't take care of animals. And is a terrible mistake to ask for a jury trial in an animal cruelty case. And sometimes I found myself thinking, and even the judges hate animal cruelty, I would find myself thinking, okay, let's keep this in perspective. But people didn't keep it in perspective. They wanted to, like, send them to jail for 10 years for it. Right. But the law is not my specialty, but testifying is something that I did a lot. Yes.
So, according to Ms. Stevenson, you teach at Pierce College and Moore Park College. I was wondering, what do you teach, and do you by chance work with the students at the teaching zoo at Moore Park College?
So when I first started teaching, I was teaching just at Pierce, but I started to feel like I really wanted to teach basic biology at the college level, not just horse science. And so I applied to teach at Moore Park College in the what's called life science. Life science is plants, bacteria, animals, that kind of thing. And so the position that was open at the time was zoology, which is animal biology. So no plants, no bacteria. Just animals. And so that's the assignment that I took, and I've taught it for quite a few years now. And so, although when you are an exotic animal training and management student, which is a program that Moore Park College has, you have already gotten certain coursework completed before you can be accepted. So you're kind of like a second year college student. And those students must have either college biology for biology majors or zoology. And so about a third, maybe a little less than that, a quarter of my zoology students are hoping to be accepted into the exotic animal training and management program. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are completing regular college life science requirement that everybody needs in order to graduate from college.
Wow. What is, like, the best part and most frustrating part of being a college professor? And what advice do you give your students in order for them to be successful?
So the best part and the most frustrating part. So I would say for me, the best part is sharing. I have a real passion for animals and for all kinds of animals, sea stars and jellyfish and grasshoppers, you know, I like it all. And I am fascinated by the way the equipment they have that allows them to survive. And I love sharing that with students. I especially love sharing it with students who don't think they care. So about half of the students that are in my class really are not, they took my class because they thought it would be less terrible than another class. They thought, well, at least I like my dog, so I'll take this class rather than one where I have to learn about plants I don't care about or bacteria. And so I like convincing them that this is fascinating. And either they are convinced, or sometimes I just say to them, if you think this is boring, don't ever tell me that. Just pretend that it's really cool. So I think that if you're a student in my class and you let yourself believe that it's cool, it is cool. And so that's the part that I love. The frustrating thing for me is that we do more dissections in zoology than in any other class at the college. And so that means it's a very expensive class for the college to run because they have to buy all of these specimens. So the frustrating thing for me is that I can't always get all of the specimens I want in the quantity I want for my class. And that's hard for me as a teacher to know that if I had more available, my students would have a better experience.
So what type of stuff would you like to dissect that you can't have?
So when in my class we start with protozoa, which are the tiny little microscopic animals that you can see swimming around in pond water or seawater, right? Really tiny. And then we go to jellyfish and to sea anemones, and then we move to the clams and the snails and the, right, like that. And then we keep going. We do lizards and turtles, and we do birds, pigeons, and all the way. And then our mammal is a rat. That's what we use. So the biggest thing that I don't always get that I want is I want males and females for every single species or class, it's really phylum, where they aren't both. So a lot of invertebrate animals that don't have bones, right, we call them invertebrates. So that's the snails and the clams and the jellyfish, for example. A lot of them, they are both male and female, but a lot of them are not. And so I want both. So I want a female grasshopper with eggs, and I want a male grasshopper with sperm. And so if all the grasshoppers I get are all male or all female, I'm very unhappy. And frogs, we do frogs for our amphibian. I want male frogs and female frogs. And so the biggest challenge to me, and I'm going to tell you a secret that you can't tell, is that I open up all the buckets and I sort through them and I look for a mix of the males and females, which may or may not be completely fair to the other classes. But I think that this is how I justify it. I think for some classes where they're not studying each phylum in great detail, maybe it doesn't matter. But for my class, it totally matters. And so I go as I do it, everything I can to make sure that we have both. But it doesn't always work out. And so sometimes we'll have pigeons, for example, and every one of them is a male. Or the worst thing is when they're very immature, they're not full grown, and so we can't see their reproductive organs clearly. So I have very particular requirements that I want and we do fish, we do perch dissection, we do lots, yeah, lots and lots. And honestly, it's amazing how much they are all the same and different, and I love teaching about it.
Yeah, that actually sounds like really fun.
So, it is.
What would your advice be to someone who is interested in a career as an equine vet or zoology professor?
So my advice is not to be discouraged if you are not the best science and math student in your class, because there is a lot of room in veterinary medicine for people who have a good way with animals and a passion for working with them that is something above and beyond the academic skill part. Now, if you're not incredibly skilled academically, you have to substitute incredibly hard work, right? I am not good at math. I have problems remembering formulas, and I struggle with basic math. And so when I was in school and I had to do, I had to pass these classes, which, by the way, were never needed for studying veterinary medicine, but I had to take them anyway, and I had to pass them anyway, I had to do a lot of practicing in order to pass those classes. They were super, super hard for me. And so, but it is possible to find a way to get through those rigorous requirements. And once you're in practice, those other skills, the animal handling skills, the people handling skills, the detective problem solving skills, the communication skills, those things turn out to be really important.
Wow, that's really cool. Thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything you'd like to add before we go to our studio audience for questions?
No, I think we've covered it.
Hi, I'm Lila Stewart, and I was wondering, has a horse ever run away while you were trying to work on them?
Yes, absolutely. One of my policies is that I always have a closed gate when I'm working on a horse. And I'm trying to think back whether I've ever actually had a horse make it all the way to the road. And I think the answer is no. But I know people who have had horses make it all the way to the road. If you've ever been to Pierce College, you know that the horse side of the campus, the ag side of the campus, is on DeSoto, which is a really major road. And the gate there for cars is open all the time. And so if the ranch gate is not closed, horses that get away can make it all the way out onto the road. And other people, not me, have had horses get away and gallop down DeSoto. So I'm a big believer in always expecting the bad thing to happen. I am not an optimistic horse handler. I am a pessimistic horse handler. And so I like to ask that question before I start. If things go really badly, what is going to happen next? Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, my name is Mamie, and I was wondering, because you mentioned purebreds, do purebred horses have health issues like some other purebred animals?
Yeah, so you're right that in many breeds of purebred dogs, the characteristics that they have, like a flat face or that kind of thing, can lead to health problems for them. And that does happen in horses as well. There are some genetic diseases that are specific to certain breeds of horses or more common in those breeds of horses, and certain kinds of muscle cramping diseases that can be very debilitating. We see primarily in quarter horses, which is kind of like a breed of horse that's like a ranch type horse, a western type horse. And we also see problems with some of the bigger draft horses that have, like the Budweiser horses, that have the really big hooves and they have the furnishings, the long feathers of hair, and that leads to sort of rashes that can get out of control underneath that hair in the back. And so there are absolutely problems that are breed and type specific in the horse world, just like in the dog world.
Thank you, because I've been wondering that for a while, so thanks for answering that.
You're welcome. There is a very famous horse, a quarter horse named Impressive. He's long gone now, but he had a genetic problem that led to a muscle defect. And he was a very popular sire, used for breeding a lot. And that got this genetic disease into the entire quarter horse breed. So that absolutely happens when a defect, a genetic defect, is present in a very popular, often used father.
Wow. Again, thank you so much, Dr. Connolly, for talking with us today about being an equine vet and zoology professor. And a big thanks to all our listeners and followers. I'm Evelyn Surendranath
with Trent Schuyler
signing off.